Take your Bible and turn to Daniel chapter 10, and we will get there in just a few minutes. So, by the way, if you are new to Fellowship Greenville, special welcome to you this morning, but let me catch you up a little bit. For about 8 months now, we have been trying to reorient ourselves to the new reality that we're living in today, and that is that as Christ followers, we are now viewed by the dominant culture as irrelevant at best and at dangerous at worst. And things have radically changed over the past 20 years or so that now our beliefs and values and morals are no longer held by a growing majority of people in our country. So one of the reasons that we've chosen these studies for the past 8 months in 1st and 2nd Peter and now here in the book of Daniel is because it's becoming more and more clear as followers of Jesus, as people who follow the teachings of Jesus, that we are becoming a minority in the world at large, but certainly a minority here in this country. And we're living with this creeping sense that the best days of the church in this culture are behind us and that the trajectory in the future is not an optimistic one. And the more apparent all this becomes, I don't know about you, but I struggle with these kinds of things. It makes you wonder, I mean, why isn't God doing something about it? Why does God allow evil and violence and chaos and just pure foolishness to be the order, or rather the disorder, of the day? Why doesn't God put a stop to it? Why doesn't God just step in and turn things around? Why would God want us to live as exiles in our own land? Anybody know what I'm talking about? You struggle with that? It just doesn't make sense. So this summer, we've been walking through the Old Testament book of Daniel and looking at how Daniel lived as an exile his whole life, as an exile in Babylon. And we've been learning what it means to remain faithful to God in a dominant culture that no longer shares our beliefs and values. And our questions are not unlike the questions that Daniel wrestled with, especially as he began to see the trajectory of the future of his own people, Israel, was not an optimistic one. And that becomes painfully clear in the final vision that Daniel receives and is recorded for us in chapters 10 through 12. Now, all those why questions that I asked earlier, there's no easy answer to why questions. But what we really need to do is focus on this question, a how question. That is, how do you remain faithful to God when you can't make sense out of what God is doing in our world, or what God is doing in our country, or what God is doing in our lives? That is the question, and chapters 10 through 12 help us answer that question. Now, before we jump into this final vision, I want to take a few minutes and do a review and kind of an overview of the book of Daniel. And rather than talk it to you, I want to show it to you using the Bible Project video on the book of Daniel that's been done by Tim Mackey. And after we watch the video, we'll jump in and into chapters 10 through 12. Okay, so y'all good with that? Okay, good, because if you said no, I was going to say we're doing it anyway. So now what we're also going to do is while we watch this video, we're going to receive our offering, all right? Okay, all right.
The book of Daniel. The story is set right after Babylon's first attack on Jerusalem, and they had plundered the city and its temple and taken a wave of Israelites into exile. Among them were four men from the royal family of David, Daniel, who's later named Belteshazzar, and his three friends, who you probably know by their Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. This book tells of their struggles to maintain hope in the land of their conquerors. The book's design seems pretty simple at first. Chapters 1 through 6 contain stories about Daniel and his friends in Babylon, while chapters 7 through 12 contain the visions of Daniel about the future. But this two-part shape is made even more interesting by another design feature, and that's the book's language. It begins in Hebrew, the language of the Israelites, but chapters 2 through 7 are written in Aramaic, a cousin language to Hebrew spoken widely among the ancient empires. But then, in chapters 8 through 12, it goes back to Hebrew. This design shows how chapters 2 through 7 are a coherent section, but it also highlights the importance of chapters 2 and 7 for understanding the later chapters of the book. Let's just dive in. Chapter 1 introduces the basic tension of the first half of the book. Daniel and his friends, they're really wise and capable, and they're recruited to serve in the royal palace of Babylon. But they're pressured to give up their Jewish identity by living and eating like Babylonians and violating the Jewish food laws found in the Torah. So they refuse, and they choose faithfulness to the Torah, and it puts them in danger. But God delivers them, and they end up being elevated by the king of Babylon. After this begins the Aramaic section, which you'll see has this really cool symmetrical design. So first, the king of Babylon has a dream that, it turns out, only Daniel is able to interpret. It's about a huge statue made of four types of metal, and it symbolizes a sequence of kingdoms, and the head is Babylon. But then a huge rock comes flying in, and it shatters the statue, and it becomes this huge mountain. Now, this dream is the first of many symbolic visions in the book, and this one introduces the basic storyline of them all. Daniel says that the statue represents a train of human kingdoms following from Babylon, and they will all fill God's world with violence. But one day, God's kingdom will come and will confront and humble the arrogant kingdoms of this world and fill the world with the healing justice of God's reign and rule. After this, chapter 3 tells the famous story of Daniel's three friends who refuse to bow down and worship a huge idol statue, which, like the statue in chapter 2, represents the king and his imperial power. And so the friends are persecuted, they're thrown into a fiery furnace, but God delivers them from death, and they're exalted by the king, who now acknowledges their God as the true one. After this come a pair of stories about two Babylonian kings, the father, Nebuchadnezzar, and then his son, Belshazzar. They're both filled with pride because of their imperial power, and so, like in chapter 2, God warns them both through dreams and then visions, which, also like chapter 2, only Daniel can interpret. He says that both kings are to humble themselves before God, and both kings arrogantly resist. So Nebuchadnezzar is stricken with madness. He becomes like a beast in the field. But then he humbles himself before God, and his humanity returns to him. He's restored as king. This is in contrast with his son, Belshazzar, who doesn't humble himself before God, and he's assassinated that very night. Now, these two stories draw this imagery from Genesis chapters 1 and 2 and Psalm 8, where humans are depicted as the royal image of God. He's given them authority to rule over the beasts of the field and the birds of the air on behalf of God, who is the world's true king. But when human kingdoms forget that, when they rebel and make themselves and their power into a god, they become less than human, like violent beasts who will face God's justice. Which brings us to chapter 6, the pair of chapter 3. And this time it's Daniel who's being persecuted because he refuses to pray and worship the king as a god. And so, like the friends, he's sentenced to death and he's thrown into a lion's den. But God delivers him from the beasts, and like the friends, the king exalts Daniel and praises his God, which brings us to chapter 7. It's the pair of chapter 2 and the center of the book where all its themes come together. It's another dream, but it's Daniel's this time. And ironically, he can't understand the dream until an angelic messenger explains it to him. He sees a series of four beasts, one like a lion, then like a bear, then one like a winged leopard, each of these symbolizing an arrogant kingdom. And last of all is a super beast, identified as a really evil empire, and it has lots of horns, a common symbol for kings in the Old Testament. And there's one specific horn who is an image of an arrogant king who exalts himself above God and persecutes God's people. Now they are symbolized by a figure called the Son of Man, who's an image for both God's covenant people, but also for their king from the line of David. But then all of a sudden, God, who's called the Ancient of Days, comes and he sets up his throne. He destroys the super beast and he exalts the Son of Man on the clouds, where he comes up to sit at God's right hand and share in God's rule over the nations. We can look back now and see how all of these stories in the first half fit together. The three stories of faithfulness despite persecution, these are meant to offer hope to God's suffering people among the nations. But they suffer because human kingdoms have rebelled against God and have become beasts. And so these visions encourage patience, that God's people are to wait for him to bring his kingdom and rule over our world and vindicate his suffering people. But it raises the question about when God is going to do that, and that's what these final three visions set out to explore. In chapter 8, Daniel has another vision about the final two beasts of chapter 7, but this time they're symbolized by a ram, who we're told is an image of the empire of the Medes and Persians, and then by a goat, who's an image of ancient Greece. And out of the goat come a whole bunch of horns, one of which symbolizes the evil king from chapter 7. And we're told more about him, that he will attack Jerusalem and exalt himself above God and defile the temple with idols. However, in the end, he will be destroyed by God, who will exalt his people and his kingdom. Now, by chapter 9, Daniel is very puzzled, especially as to when all of this is going to take place. And so he consults the scroll of the prophet Jeremiah, where God said that Israel's exile would only last 70 years. So for Daniel, the 70 years is almost up. And so he asks God to fulfill his promise soon. But an angel comes and informs him that Israel's sin and rebellion has continued. And so their time of exile and oppression will continue on 7 times longer than Jeremiah envisioned. Daniel is deeply disturbed by this, and he has one final vision. We're shown the same sequence of kingdoms. It's Persia, then Greece, and Alexander the Great, followed by lesser kings, all leading up to this final king of the north, who will invade Jerusalem, set up idols in the temple, and exalt himself above God. But then, all of a sudden, this king comes to ruin. Now, there's been endless debate about what all of these visions refer to. Many see a clear connection to the exploits of the Syrian king Antiochus in the 160s BC. He killed many faithful Jews in Jerusalem and set up idols in the temple. Others think it points forward to the Roman Empire's role in the execution of Jesus and the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in AD 70. And still others think it will be fulfilled in future events that have yet to happen when Jesus will return. Now the problem is that the symbols and the numbers, they don't quite match any of these views perfectly. But it opens up the possibility that in a sense they are all right. The book of Daniel has been designed to offer hope to all future generations of God's people. It did so in the days of Antiochus's empire, and it has ever since. This is why Jesus could use imagery from Daniel to describe and confront the oppressive leaders he confronted in Jerusalem. This is why John, the visionary who wrote the Revelation, could adapt Daniel's visions and apply them to Rome of his day and also all future oppressive empires. And so the point of Daniel is that all generations of readers can find here a pattern and a promise. It's a pattern that human beings and their kingdoms become violent beasts when they glorify their own power, when they redefine right and wrong, and don't acknowledge God as their true king. But Daniel also holds out a promise that one day God will confront the beast. He will rescue his world and his people by bringing his kingdom over all nations. And so for every generation, this book speaks a message of hope that should motivate faithfulness. And that's what the book of Daniel is all about.
What you think? Pretty amazing, isn't it? I mean, by the way, all of these videos are available at the Bible Project website. You can download them for free. And the whole poster there of the synopsis of the book, the summary of the book, it's there. You can download those as PDF files for free. When I see that and I think about how God put together the book of Daniel, I mean, the organization of the book is as brilliant as the teaching of the book. And I just think that's really, really neat. So this week we are looking at the final section, that final vision given to Daniel, found in chapters 10 through 12 there in the lower right-hand corner. And again, from last week in chapter 9, we saw that Daniel discovered from the book of Jeremiah that the exile in Babylon would last 70 years, and he does the math, and he can see that the exile is almost over. So he prays to God, confesses his sins and the sins of his people, and he cries out to God for mercy, cries out for God to keep his promise. And in answer to his prayer, the angel Gabriel comes to him and basically says, yes, the 70 years is almost up, and the Israelites exiled in Babylon will go back to their homeland after 70 years, but 70 years is not long enough to atone for the sins of the people, and it's not long enough to usher in God's new age of eternal righteousness. It's just not long enough. And so he says it's not going to be 70 years, it's going to be 70 weeks of years, or 77s of years, or in other words, 490 years before God's final salvation comes to his people. And we know that it actually takes longer than that. So Daniel's thinking 70 years. Gabriel says, no, it's going to take seven times longer than that. And that's a real bummer. But the bad news gets worse, because even when about 40,000 or so Jews return to their homeland and start rebuilding the walls of the city and rebuilding the temple and rebuilding the city itself, it's in the midst of constant conflict and opposition, and things don't get any better. In fact, it's harder on them back in Jerusalem than it is for the ones that stayed behind living in Babylon. And the bad news gets even worse, because what Daniel learns in this vision is that God has decreed that there will be centuries after centuries of wars and rumors of wars until the time of the end, meaning that God has decreed that the beastly kingdoms of men will make life hard and at times unbearable for the people of God. So things aren't going to get better. They will get worse until the time of God's final salvation. Now, by the way, that doesn't mean that there aren't ever any good seasons for the people of God. We've enjoyed a good season as the people of God here. I mean, but in that day, like while the beastly kingdom of Persia was conquering one nation after another, and then after that, the beastly kingdom of the Greeks ran roughshod over one nation after another, and there were constant wars and conflicts and violence. That didn't mean that necessarily that a Jewish shopkeeper who lived there in Babylon, or a Jewish carpenter living in Jerusalem, it didn't mean that they experienced one painful experience after another and never had a moment's peace. No, it just means that until God's final salvation comes, God's people will continue to live under one beastly empire after another, eventually culminating in a final showdown between God and Babylon. And what I mean by Babylon here is Babylon is the symbol of any kingdom or any system of government that rises up to oppose God and His will and His ways in this world. So all that to say, point is, the revelation Daniel receives is not good news. And that's what we're about to look at in chapters 10 through 12. Now, this final vision takes up three chapters. It's long and it's detailed, and we're not going to cover everything. I'm sure you're glad about that. But I'm going to touch down at a couple of key points to help us get the big picture of what's going on. So Daniel chapter 10, I'm going to begin reading in verse 1. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a word, a revelation, came to Daniel, who was named Belteshazzar, and the word was true, and it concerned a great conflict, a great ongoing conflict. And Daniel understood the word and had understanding of the vision up to a point, as we're going to see. In those days, after I received the vision, I, Daniel, mourned for 3 weeks. It was so disturbing, he says, that I ate no delicacies, no meat or wine entered my mouth, nor did I anoint myself with essential oils or lotions from Beauty Counter. He didn't do that for the full 3 weeks, and I know some of you really like your oils and your lotions, and that could be hard for you, but evidently, no oils and no lotions is a clear universal sign of mourning. All right, so now he's going to start to unpack this vision that bothered him so much. Verse 4, on the 24th day of the first month, I was standing on the bank of the great river Tigris, and I lifted up my eyes and looked, and there was a man clothed in linen with a belt of fine gold from Uphaz around his waist, and his body was like beryl, there's the gemstone, beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like a gleaming of burnished bronze, and the sound of his words was like a sound of a multitude of people talking at once. And I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, for the men who were with me didn't see the vision, but a great trembling fell upon them, and they fled to hide themselves. So I was left alone, and I saw this great vision. When I saw it, it sucked the life out of me. No strength was left in me. My appearance was fearfully changed, and I retained no strength. And then I heard the sound of his words, and as I heard the sound of his words, I fell on my face to the ground in a deep sleep. I mean, this is intense, right? I mean, anybody have an experience like this past week? No, probably not. So, verse 10, and behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. So he's gotten up from his face, he's on all fours, And the man said to me, "O Daniel, man greatly loved." Now, I think that's so cool. He addresses him, "Daniel, you are greatly loved. Understand the words that I speak to you and stand up, for now I've been sent to you." And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. And he said, "Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before God, your words have been heard, and I've come in answer to your prayer. I've come because of your words, because of your praying. But I would have been here sooner, but the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me for 21 days, but Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I was left there with the kings of Persia." He's talking about spiritual warfare, and I'll come back to that next week. "But I have come to you to make you understand what has happened to your people in the latter days, for the vision is for the days yet to come." Now, some people feel like and think that this heavenly being was a pre-incarnate visitation of Jesus, because the description of this being here sounds a whole lot like the description of Jesus found in the first chapter of the book of Revelation. And that may be. The problem I have with that view is that I have a hard time seeing Jesus needing help from the archangel Michael to fight demonic forces in order to get a message through to Daniel. So I take it that this is a description of what many, not all, but many heavenly beings might look like, which would include Jesus in his heavenly form. But suffice it to say, whoever this is, we need to pay careful attention to what he tells us about what will happen in the latter days, in the days yet to come. So the unfolding of the vision begins in chapter 11, verse 2. So fast forward there. I'm going to begin reading in chapter 11, verse 2. "And now I'll tell you the truth. Three more kings will arise in Persia, and then a fourth will be far richer than all the others. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king will arise who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. But not long after he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not by his descendants, nor having the same authority which he had ruled, because his kingdom will be uprooted and given to others." Now, what we're reading here goes back to chapter 2, the great statue that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream about, and we looked at that earlier. Tim talked about it in the video. This was a symbol of the train of kingdoms that would follow from Daniel's time on. So it starts with Babylon, then goes to Persia and Greece, and on and on and on to the time of the end, which corresponds to Daniel's strange vision about the beasts in chapter 7. And Jim walked us through this section here, and we learned how the lion beast was Babylon, and the bear was Persia, and the four-headed leopard was Greece. And then we have the super beast, which I take, along with Tim Mackey, to be a symbol of all the beastly kingdoms, including Rome, that will oppress God's people up until the Antichrist of the last days. But here in chapter 11, Daniel has another vision, and this time there's no statues, there's no animals, but he's talking about this train of nations, starting with Babylon, and then Persia, of which Daniel is living in the Persian Empire right now as he writes these things. But here's the deal. All these visions are about the same thing. They're about how human beastly kingdoms come and go, rise and fall, one after another, and God's in control of it all, and they're all basically the same. They will exalt their national identity and their authority and shake their fist in the face of God, and they will redefine good and evil, and they will succeed by violence and by the death of the innocent. And in this final vision, Daniel gets an overview of human history, focusing first on the rise and fall of Persia, which, by the way, anybody see the movie 300? Some of you did. Okay, well, that movie is about the Battle of Thermopylae in 480 BC between the Persian king Xerxes, who is Esther's king from the Bible, and Xerxes attacks Greece. And remember verse 2, he will stir up everyone against Greece. So that's historical prophecy right there. And then we see the rise and fall of Greece, and specifically we're told of a mighty king that comes from Greece that makes the kingdom huge and powerful. Who was the mighty king in Greece that made the Greek Empire huge and powerful? Who are we talking about? Alexander the Great, that's right. Alexander the Great. Now, some of you are history nerds, and you're going to love all this, this next 5 minutes or so. And some of you are not history nerds, and you're going to be bored for the next 5 minutes. Now, the thing is, just hang in there, because there's a really good pop at the end of this, all right? This is really, really interesting. But Alexander, when he was in his 20s, he came from Macedonia in Greece, and he conducted the largest military expedition that the world had ever seen. And his kingdom, the Greek Empire, stretched all the way from Greece down to southern Europe, and it spread all the way down to Egypt and through the Middle East over to India. So he built this huge empire through this massive military campaign. Before he actually got to rule, verse 4, not long after he had arisen, he died at the age of 32, and he died in Nebuchadnezzar's palace in Babylon. Isn't that interesting? And the text says, verse 4, that his descendants didn't rule over it, which is absolutely true. His descendants were killed off by his four generals. Remember the four-headed leopard. And so these prophecies are pretty specific, wouldn't you agree? So here's the flow of this final vision again, bottom right-hand corner. It starts with Babylon, then Persia, then Greece, and then a train of lesser kings, and these are the horns of the beast in chapter 7. And then in verses 5 through 45, which we are not going to read, all right? Aren't you happy? We're not going to read 5 through 45, but then as history goes on, it zeroes in on two horns referred here in chapter 11 as the king of the south, which is the king of Egypt, and the king of the north, which is Syria. And basically what you're reading in chapter 11 is a vision of the description of the history of Middle Eastern military politics after Alexander the Great. Starts around 400 BC, comes down to 300, 200, all the way to the 160s. And biblically speaking, all these things occurred between the time of Malachi and Matthew, the 400 silent years before Jesus. And this vision is quite detailed, even soap opera-esque at times, because we're told about these political marriages and sex scandals, all of which you can read about in your history books. And then the vision zeroes in on the king of the north, that super bad guy. He's the little horn of the goat in Daniel 8. And here's what the super bad guy will do. Look down in verse 31. His armed forces will rise to desecrate the temple fortress and abolish daily sacrifice. Temple, what city are we talking about? Jerusalem, that's right. And then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation, and with flattery he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. So what he is describing right here is a very clear event in history. Happened in the 160s BC. This king of the north was a Syrian king named Antiochus IV, or Antiochus Epiphanes, like Antiochus, look at me, I'm God. The Jewish people called him Antiochus Epimenes, which meant madman. He thought he was God, they thought he was a madman. You can read, if you're a history nerd, you can read all about that in the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees, ancient Jewish texts from this period. So Antiochus comes and he takes over Jerusalem, and he makes it illegal to be a practicing Jew in Jerusalem, and anybody he caught reading the Torah or practicing Jewish rituals or traditions, he would put them in prison or put them to death. He set up a big idol to his god, Zeus, right in the temple, sacrificed a pig on the altar, and Antiochus would bring one Jewish person a day and force them to bow down to Zeus, and if they didn't, he would torture them publicly until they gave in, and if they didn't give in, they died. And that's what is described here. And all scholars see what is written here as actual historical events, even liberal scholars. But because of what's written in Daniel 11, because it's so specific, liberal scholars believe that Daniel was written after the events occurred. They say that all these specific things were not really prophecy, just history written as if it were prophecy. But if that's true, why would people keep reading the book and gaining insight and comfort from it? So now, of course, we don't believe that, but here's the punch. This is where I want you to hang with me to this point right here. There are over 135 specific prophecies in this chapter. Fulfilled prophecies. We look back, they were fulfilled in history. 135 of them. Now, what does that tell you about your Bible? I mean, that, wow. I mean, now here's, but here's the point, though. As encouraging as it is for us to, us looking back, it was not at all encouraging to Daniel looking forward. Because what he's coming to see is that there will be a long history of war and violence and the blood of the innocent being shed and trampled on by the beastly kingdoms of this world, and it just doesn't make any sense to Daniel, and it literally makes him sick. Now this is so important, because what we're actually being told here is that Antiochus Epiphanes sets the pattern for all future beastly kingdoms that will follow. There will be many little horns throughout history who exalt themselves and their kingdoms to the place of God, and those kingdoms, those little super bad guys, will make life very hard for God's people, and it's going to be like that until Jesus comes and sets up his kingdom on earth. And we know that early Christians, looking forward to the return of Christ, they read and they reflected on the book of Daniel as not just referring to the past, but to their own day. And it's exactly what you see in the book of Revelation, where you have John the visionary writing a letter to seven churches in what we call today modern-day Turkey. And the Christians in those churches were facing intense persecution from the Roman Empire. But Rome is never mentioned in the by name in the book of Daniel or the book of Revelation. But what we see here is this super bad guy in the book of Revelation, the Antichrist, who is the embodiment of the savage beast called Babylon. And so what Daniel is doing, and what Jesus is doing when he talks about all of this, and what the book of Revelation is doing, is it showing us that these beasts, these visions, these super bad rulers and kings, Babylon, if you will, they're all filling out a pattern that will characterize life in this world until the final day, which brings us that to the left hand of the scroll that we looked at a few moments ago. And it was true for Antiochus in the 160s. Then it was true of Rome and the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And it also describes the events that will occur before Jesus comes back. So the revelation, the vision, is that things are going to be bad, and they're going to stay bad for a long time. Because when broken, sinful people individually give in to evil, and then they get together and gain power and magnify their evil into a system of government, think Hitler, for instance, you get a savage beast. And so what Daniel sees is that evil and violence and the unfolding of the blood of the innocent isn't going to stop. And somebody told me between services what happened in El Paso and Dayton. It's the blood of the innocent is going to continue to be shed. This is our world. And it'll continue right up to the end, whenever that is. And Daniel is deeply disturbed. He says in chapter 10, he said, as I stood gazing at the vision, I was trying to take it in, but I had no strength. My face turned deathly pale. He says, I was helpless. I was speechless. I was weak, overcome with anguish. He said, I could barely even breathe, because he knows this great ongoing conflict, war, violence, beastly oppression will continue to happen. It just doesn't make any sense. Why didn't God stop it? So the question for Daniel is the same question for us, because we still see all this going on in our world today, like the events of yesterday. And did you know that there are more than 40 armed conflicts going on in our world today, and Christians are caught in the crosshairs of many of them? It just doesn't make any sense. So again, the question is, how do you remain faithful to God when what God is doing or not doing in the world just doesn't make any sense? Chapter 12. Now, remember, this is apocalyptic literature, a type of literary genre in which a visionary or a prophet is shown a set of visions that are very weird and very odd, full of symbolism, and that makes it hard, makes them hard to understand. And there, and the one of the reasons that they're also hard to understand, not just because of the symbolism, but because in these visions, sometimes the flow of time goes one thing after another, you know, like Babylon, Persia, Greece. But then in prophecy, what happens a lot of times, it'll be one thing after another, after another, after another, and then it jumps way down to the end and jumps to the end time. And that's what we have here in chapter 12. So as we start reading chapter 12, you need to know that even though it sounds like the events of chapter 12 follow right after the events of chapter 11, the fact is, and pretty much all scholars, whether they're amill, premill, or panmill, like it'll all pan out in the end or whatever, all scholars believe that when you get to chapter 12, verses 1 through 4, we fast forward to the events of the final days, to the time of the end. All right, chapter 12, verse 1. At that time, at the end time, Michael will arise, the great prince who has charge of your people, the guardian angel of the nation of Israel. At that time, there will be trouble such as never has been since there was a nation until that time. But at that time, look at this, at that time, your people will be delivered. That is, everyone whose name is found written in the book of life. But now, finally, this is finally, good news. The angel isn't just saying, buckle up, it's going to be really, really bad forever. He's saying, no, there's an end point to all of this. He's saying that all the suffering that your people have experienced, and not only your people, but God's people to come, he says, there will be an end to suffering. This is God's promise. Something will be done. Something will be done. Something will annihilate the savage beastly cycle once and for all. So he says, yes, there will be ongoing conflict, but at the end of time, your people, everybody whose name is written in the book of life, they will be delivered. So this is the first glimpse of hope in the text. He's saying it will come to an end. Daniel, your people will be delivered. So exactly what does that deliverance look like? Verse 2. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting disgrace. So this is the Old Testament way of talking about death, like from dust you came and to dust you'll return, all right? And it's also talking here about the final resurrection of the dead at the end of the age, which that's what the Jewish people, how they envisioned resurrection. But this is actually the first reference to a bodily, physical resurrection in the Bible, right here. So he says, one day everyone who has ever died will awake, some to eternal life, and some to shame and eternal disgrace. That is, some will arise to an eternal future with God, and some will awake to an eternal future apart from God, separated from God, forever. So Daniel is taking all this in. And as we'll see in a few more verses, Daniel hears all this, but it doesn't make him go, oh, okay, I see, I feel better now. He's not feeling better yet. So the angel goes on in verse 3, and he says, and those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the sky above, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Now, he's not trying to be super lyrical here, he's not trying to cue up a Chris Tomlin song or something. I mean, he's talking about the fact that some of those who are raised from the dead to eternal life, those who have been wise and influential, they will be rewarded. Daniel's still not feeling better. Verse 4, he says, but you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. In those days, many will run to and fro, and knowledge will increase. Point being, at that time, the time of the end, people will be searching for the knowledge that I've given to you, so seal it up for them. Now he starts, now the whole thing shifts, and Daniel starts speaking in the first person. Verse 5. Then I, Daniel, looked, and there before me stood two other angels, one on this bank of the stream and one on that bank of the stream. And one of them said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the stream, how long will it be until all these astonishing things are fulfilled? So even the angels don't know how it's all going to pan out in the end. They're wondering about all of this. But they're really, this is all staged for Daniel's benefit. Verse 7, "And I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the stream. He raised his right hand and his left hand toward heaven, and he swore by the Ancient of Days." This is how long? A time, times, and a half a time. "And that when the shattering of the power of the holy people comes to an end, these things will be finished." Now this question, how long is it going to be till all these things come to pass? I mean, that's an important question, isn't it? I mean, and Daniel hears the answer, but it had to be frustrating. Now, depending on whatever your view of end time prophecy may be, you go, "Oh, I know what that means. That's referring to the last 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation in the book of Revelation." Well, you might think you know what it means, and it might mean that. Daniel had not a clue. Daniel didn't know what it means. He can't put it together. It doesn't make any sense. So he says, "Yes, tell me how long." What do you mean, time, times, and half a time? Look at verse 8. "I heard, but I didn't understand." Just like what you say after you listen to one of my messages. So Daniel asked the question himself. He says, "Oh my Lord, what will be? What will be the outcome of these terrible things? All these things." I mean, I can hear desperation in his voice. "Lord, tell me, please tell me. I can't make it all make sense. What will the outcome be? How long and how does all this end?" Now, imagine that you're Daniel and you're about to get this answer to that question, verse 9. Here's the how long, what's the outcome? Here's the answer, verse 9. "Go your way." Go your way, Daniel. In other words, keep doing what you're doing. Continue to be faithful. Continue to live the way that I ask you to live. Continue to trust that at the right time, in God's timing, all these things will be fulfilled. That's it? That's it? Oh, no, that's not it. The final words of this last chapter, this grand finale, if you will, they don't help either. At least not at first. He says, "For the words are shut up and sealed until the time of the end. Many will be purified and make themselves white and be refined, but the wicked will continue to act wickedly." In other words, Babylon will be Babylon to the very end. Don't expect them to be any different. "But those who are wise will understand." They'll understand things like this, verse 11. "And from the time that the regular burnt offering is taken away and the abomination that makes desolate is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he who waits and arrives at the 335 days. Daniel, you got that right? He didn't get it. It made no sense. "I guess you're not as wise as we thought you were." I mean, this is another one of those numerical mystery things, like the time, times, and half a time. I mean, the whole thing about 1,290 days and 335 days, yes, 1,290 is 30 days longer than 1260, which is a 3.5 year period, I get that, and 335 days is 45 days longer than the 1,290 days, nobody knows what this means. Nobody. Nobody. Now, people can say they know it, but they don't know. But here's the deal. This is the point of all this. Just like we know more about these visions than Daniel did, God's people in a future day will know more about some of these things than we do. And I'm good with that. You? Because many of the things that God's prophets talked about were not written for their benefit, but for ours and for people in the future who will need more information. Verse 13. Here it is again. "But go your way until the end. You will rest, and then at the end of days you will rise again to receive the inheritance set aside for you." So he says, "Go your way." In other words, here's what he's saying now. Don't ask me about this anymore. Don't ask me about it. Not helpful. I mean, and then he says, "Oh, by the way, you will rest," and that means Daniel is going to die, and he's going to die in Persia. Now, it meant that he was going to live out, he's probably about 85, and some people say that he lived to maybe 105. I don't know how they know that, but he lived to a ripe old age. But it meant that he was going to live out the rest of his days in exile, and he wouldn't get to go home, which in Jewish culture, it's a big deal to be buried in your homeland, especially in your hometown. Now, this is interesting. According to Jewish and Muslim tradition, which Muslims also hold Daniel in high regard, Daniel was buried in Susa, which was the place he received the vision in chapter 8. It's the place where Esther lived. And so they actually, they have a tomb there. This is a picture of Daniel's tomb in modern day Susa. Pretty amazing. It's still not like being buried in your hometown for a Jew. And so he's told, you won't go home alive and you won't go home dead. And Daniel, at least at first, this had to be like a punch in the gut. I mean, he had been faithful all these years, faithful. And he's not going to enjoy what he hoped for all his life. It doesn't make any sense. But then verse 13, notice how personal this whole vision. The vision has been about kingdoms and all this stuff, but it does come down to become very personal. And the angel says, you're going to die. You will rest, but you will rise. You will rest, but you will rise. And you will see the fulfillment of every prophetic promise I've spoken to you. You will see it with your eyes, with your living, breathing body, and you will see and inherit all that's been promised. You will see how the weird statue of nations and the weird animal dreams of the nations. You'll see how it all fits into God's plan. You'll see and know, not in part but in full, how it all has worked together to accomplish God's great plan of redemption and salvation. Now, that's the hope. Feeling better? If I'm totally honest with you, I was hoping for a little more glitz and glam here with the grand finale at the end of the book. Now, it's been a long time since I did an in-depth study in the book of Daniel. It was way back in the 80s at Dallas Seminary. And I hadn't really thought much about how the book ends. But I was hoping for a little more fanfare. Like, I mean, this is Daniel, for goodness sake. Daniel, who was a teenager, risked his life for God over not eating pork. This is Daniel, who was saved from the lions in the den. Daniel, who hung out with world leaders of his day and got promoted to top cabinet positions in his government. This is Daniel, who interpreted dreams for kings, although he couldn't interpret his own. He had to have angels and heavenly beings come to help him, help explain it to him, which is the point. Angels and heavenly beings came to help him understand these things, and he had long conversations with them. And twice in these chapters, he's called a man greatly loved by God. So Daniel here is the definition of remaining faithful to God as an exile in a foreign country. And he's told, go your way. Go back to your job. Go back to your home. Get your house in order. You're going to die. But hey, you'll rise on the last day. I'm like, this guy should get a crown or a parting gift, I mean, it sounds like a small thing, but even to have his body carried back to Jerusalem, his homeland, like in Exodus, when after Joseph died, and the children of Israel went back to the promised land, they carried Joseph's bones back to the promised land and buried him there. Like, why not Daniel? It's kind of like this. Like, it's like if you were really struggling with some really bad stuff, like your really bad health issue, or you living with this constant pain that won't go away, or maybe you're mad or sad or anxious or angry about something going on in your life or the trajectory of our country, and you just can't get off your mind. And so you make an appointment with Jim Thompson to go in to talk to your pastor about it, and you go in and you pour your heart out to Jim. And then after you talk for 45 minutes, he says, well, think about this. When you die, you're going to go to heaven. It's like, right? You feel better? That's what's weird about the end of this book. Daniel didn't get to see the fulfillment of everything he hoped for his whole life. I mean, I'd like to see God come down in a flaming chariot and carry him off to heaven like he did Elijah, you know, or God to come and take him without him seeing death like Enoch, or God at least burying him in the promised land, you know, like he did Moses probably. And so if this is how it really ends, then we have to ask, what hope is there from Daniel's point of view? What in the world would move this man forward? How does he go his way and continue to remain faithful and finish strong when there's still so much that doesn't make sense? So many unanswered questions. What in the world would give him hope? And what kind of hope could move him and his people and us beyond disappointment and beyond heartbreak and beyond suffering and beyond piercing self-denial of personal desires? What kind of hope compels us to persevere and do so with great resolve, to be willing to pay any price? I mean, those are heavy questions. But they are the questions. But those questions make me back up and go, but what is hope anyway? I really like this definition of hope. John Mark Comer writes that hope is the absolute expectation of coming good based on the character of God. Hope is the confident, absolute expectation of the coming good based on the character of God. Hope is not optimism. You realize that. Hope is not optimism. Optimism thinks the best. It's the glass half full mentality. Nothing wrong with being an optimistic person. There's a lot right with it. But the problem is optimism can be rooted in itself, in what it can think up and what it can accomplish. Optimism thinks the best, but it's rooted in its own ability. It's that weird Oprah crap. Like, if I can believe it, I can receive it. You know, or I can do all things through me because I think I can, you know, or whatever. Now, if I'm offending you, good. Because that stuff's garbage. Like, I'm serious. Now, hear me. I'm not trying to dishonor anybody here, but I'm telling you, that's not hope. Because it's based on what you can accomplish, and what and that kind of hope will disappoint, because we're all broken people. We can't make life in a broken world come out the way that we want. So you can't depend on brokenness to deliver. Let me say that again. You can't depend on what's broken to deliver, not consistently anyway. And hope is not wishful thinking. I mean, you know, like I hope I find a parking place, or I hope she texts me back, or I hope it doesn't rain tomorrow, or I hope I get a tax refund this year, or I hope the next Star Wars movie is better than the last one. Or I hope I get into Clemson. No, you don't. Hope is, yeah, I know. Hope is not wishful thinking. According to the Bible, hope calls for us to place our faith and trust in God and God alone. We place our faith and trust in His wisdom. He really knows what's best for us. His love, He will always accomplish what's best for us because He loves us. We are greatly loved. And it rests in His good for our lives, even though sometimes His good doesn't seem so good. Biblical hope, gospel hope, looks forward to the ultimate good that God has promised us in Christ. And what you see, the fact is Daniel could not have had the hope of God's ultimate salvation that we have. There were still too many blanks yet to be filled in. He couldn't have had the hope that we have, but he was looking for it. He was looking for it. Now, when I wrote that in my manuscript as I was working on this message, when I wrote that line, he was looking for it, I was taken back to a passage that we studied earlier in the year in 1 Peter, another book about exile. And I remembered something from 1 Peter, and so I went back and I was trying to find it, and I finally found it, and when I found it and I read it, it took on a whole new significance for it. I literally got goosebumps. So just listen to this. Don't turn. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 10. Concerning this salvation, the prophets who spoke of the grace that was coming to you searched intently and with the greatest care, trying to find out the time and circumstances to which the Spirit of Christ in them was pointing when he predicted the sufferings of the Messiah and the glories that would follow. It was revealed to them that they were not serving themselves but you. When they spoke of the things that have now been told to you by those who preached the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, even angels long to look into these things. Therefore, with minds that are alert and fully sober, fix your hope on the grace to be brought to you when Jesus Christ is revealed at his coming. Whew. I mean, do you see how many of the things that Peter says here about the prophets of old are true from what we just studied in Daniel? Daniel sought intently to understand these visions and what they meant for God's people in his day and in days to come. He wanted to know the time and the circumstances and the ultimate outcome that all these visions were pointing to. And it was revealed to him in the sealing up of the vision that he was not serving himself, but he was serving us and those coming after him. He was serving the people of God in a future day. And I think he was good in that when it was revealed to him. And he saw, and we saw, how angels were there longing to know how long till God's great salvation would come to set things right. Still gives me goosebumps. For Daniel and for us, remaining faithful to God in a world that's growing more and more hostile to our faith, in a world where we can't always make sense out of why God does what he does or why he's not doing what we think he should do, to remain faithful, we need a hope that is sure and secure. But first, you'll never get to that hope until you settle once and for all that you don't have to understand everything. That what God chooses to not reveal to you, you got to be okay with it. Like, I don't know. I don't understand why God's doing that. I don't understand why things aren't working out this way. You got to give that up. Because only then are you free to fix your hope, not on the things of this broken world, but in Jesus and the world to come when he returns to make this world new. The world to come is our true home and true destination. And we're just exiles here. We remain faithful in exile by fixing our hope on Jesus and on the coming good that he will bring, on the grace that he will lavish on us when he returns, that is, everyone whose name is written in the book of life, who have trusted him by faith. And so the question is, have you set your hope fully on the grace that'll be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus?